The committee will come to order. We do have a quorum present. Clerk will note the roll. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes from March 22nd, 2016? Representative Gruenhagen moves approval of the minutes for March 22nd, 2016. Is there any corrections to that? Seeing none, we'll vote for adoption of that. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Today we have some bonding proposals in our committee, the TETRA committee. I plan to lay these over. As I said yesterday, what we're going to be doing is rather than acting on them either affirmatively or not, we will just hold all the bills over and note those in a letter to the chair of the Capital Investment Committee. We have before us House File 2496. Representative Albright, welcome to the committee. I will move House File 2496 be laid over. The bill is before us. Representative Albright, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I believe there is an amendment in the packet.
There's an amendment A16-0901. That's the author's amendment. I will move A16-0901. Is there any discussion to that amendment? Seeing no discussion, all of those in favor of adoption of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Representative Albright, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Welcome the opportunity to present one of the bonding projects, I think, of substantial import to a number of counties in the South Metro, as well as the overall metropolitan area of Minneapolis-St. Paul. The amendment that we just adopted for the benefit of the bill actually identifies the site now on which this facility will presumably be attached and built. I have with me this afternoon the medical director for the medical examiner's office, as well as a favorite person of mine from Scott County, my very own county commissioner, Barbara Marshall. And they would both like to share with you testimony to the effect of the import of this bill.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Welcome to the committee. Dr. Baker, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you much, very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Andrew Baker, and I am the chief medical examiner for Hennepin, Dakota, and Scott counties. I have been a practicing forensic pathologist in the state of Minnesota for 14 years and a chief medical examiner since 2004. In January of 2013, Dakota and Scott counties entered into a partnership with Hennepin County for full-service death investigation and autopsies. With the nationwide shortage of qualified medical examiners, the increasingly stringent standards of forensic sciences, and the need for modern facilities to house the work we do, the former medical examiner's office in the basement of the hospital in Hastings was not a viable long-term model for Dakota County or its partners. Building its own morgue, even assuming the practitioners to staff it could have been found, would have been cost prohibitive for a single county. It only made sense for counties like ours to partner to provide this mission-critical component of government. I'm very proud to note that this Dakota-Scott-Hennepin partnership is well into its fourth year of operation, and our regional medical examiner's office now provides death investigation and autopsy services to one-third of Minnesota families. In 2015, our regional system investigated more than 7,200 deaths and performed nearly 1,200 autopsies. In 2000, the first full year in the facility that we now occupy, we investigated only half as many deaths and performed 610 autopsies. All of this takes place in a 50-year-old former food service facility that was retrofitted in 1999 to become a morgue. The public impact of modern death investigation systems cannot be overemphasized. While the murders and high-profile deaths we investigate capture the public attention, they are a single-digit percentage of our workload. Far more common are the sudden natural deaths where a proper autopsy arms surviving family members with life-saving information and allays the concerns of law enforcement that foul play was present, or the recognition of an infectious disease such as an influenza or a meningitis that poses a threat to the community at large. Equally important is our recognition of accidental deaths, such as the increasingly common deaths we see from heroin and toxicity of other opiates. The role of a modern medical examiner's office extends far beyond investigating deaths and performing autopsies. We provide or contract for a number of laboratory activities such as toxicological and infectious disease testing. We manage, now in a nearly paperless environment, an array of records ranging from police reports to hospital charts to death scene photographs. We work with families and tissue agencies in every case where donation is feasible. We sit on committees that evaluate the care of our most vulnerable citizens, from newborns to the elderly to those with mental and physical impairments. And we are a key component of local, regional, and statewide disaster planning. Think back to the days and weeks after August 1st of 2007, when an eight-lane bridge plummeted into the Mississippi River during rush hour. Imagine your community's response had your medical examiner been unprepared and untrained for such a tragedy. The biggest challenge facing medical examiners today is ensuring that we recruit and retrain the qualified and talented physicians required to staff a medical examiner system. To be a medical examiner in Minnesota requires a four-year undergraduate degree, a four-year medical degree, 3 to 5 years of training in pathology, an additional year of training in forensic pathology, and passing several grueling board examinations. For most medical examiners, this is 13 or more years of post-high school education. We have approximately 500 medical examiners practicing full-time in the United States. By most estimates, we need at least 1,100. The short-term outlook for remedying this problem is not good. Any serious discussion of a regional medical examiner system and facility must recognize that a major driver is recruiting and retention. Expecting the most qualified individuals to work in aging, unaccredited facilities will be disastrous. As you can see in the handout that I provided to you, no less than the Wall Street Journal now finds this nationwide shortage problematic. We have four medical examiner offices serving Minnesota: my office, Ramsey County, Anoka County, and the Mayo Clinic. Several offices in northwest Minnesota currently transport their cases to Grand Forks. Much of Minnesota remains covered by a coroner system, meaning that rather than having a medical examiner, a local physician decides how deaths get investigated and whether and where an autopsy will be performed. As coroners around the state prepare to retire, county boards must decide whether to maintain the status quo or partner with a nationally accredited medical examiner office such as mine. Offices like mine should be built and staffed to provide more and more services across the state of Minnesota. The current Dakota Scott Hennepin facility is already at capacity by 2016 standards. We have approximately 29,000 usable square feet, which should have closer to 34,000. We can store some 36 to 45 bodies in our cooler, but need twice that much. We have 5 working autopsy stations, but we need 9. For long-term planning, our consultants used Minnesota State Demographer data for our region through 2040 in order to plan and design a facility that would serve the region's needs for the decades to come. The ideal facility, poised to serve the region for the next 20 years or more, would have 50,000 usable square feet, be able to store in excess of 108 bodies, and have 13 autopsy stations. If we elect to do nothing, the risks are fairly predictable. As we continue to exceed capacity, we will not be able to recruit and retain the talented physicians we need. Our accreditation will likely be revoked. Loss of accreditation will leave the public and media wondering about the accuracy of our reports and the qualifications of the doctors who prepared them. An inability to expand will leave other Minnesota counties unable to find qualified medical examiner services and meet national standards when their coroners retire. Ultimately, those who would suffer the most would be the families we serve, those who would wait months rather than weeks for their loved ones' autopsy findings, or those left to wonder forever because of the autopsies we are simply no longer able to do. Our current facility is many decades old and lacks any feasible options for expansion. Our current location slows response times, detracts from customer service, will be a detriment to retaining the talent we need, and will deter other Minnesota counties from joining a nationally renowned and accredited death investigation system. The proposal before you is a request for state bonding money for one half of the cost of construction of a new regional medical examiner facility. Such a facility would be designed to serve not only the growing population of the current Dakota Scott Hennepin region, but fully prepared to onboard additional coroner counties for whom a new and geographically convenient medical examiner facility would make sense. As you heard prior to my testimony, we now have a location ideally situated in southern Hennepin County on a major transportation corridor between two other corridors that will optimize convenience for families and all of our current and future partners. I thank the committee for its interest in this project, and in particular, Representative Albright for championing this bill.
Thank you, Dr. Baker. We do appreciate you being here and for the great work that you do. We also have Commissioner Barbara Marshall. Would you like to introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I would also like to thank Representative Albright for being the author of our bill. I am Barbara Marshall. I am the current chair of the Scott County Board of Commissioners. One of the vital services provided by government is the investigation of deaths and infectious diseases. This essential service supports both the criminal justice system and the public health system. And as you've heard from Dr. Baker, it requires a significant amount of education, training, and infrastructure to provide this service at the level our citizens expect and deserve. Since November of 2001, Scott County has provided medical examiner services through a joint powers agreement in collaboration with other counties, led by Dakota County, at Regina Hospital in Hastings. Beginning in 2013, Scott and Dakota counties entered into a collaborative agreement with Hennepin County for these services. In large part, there were three factors that influenced our decision to make this change. First, it was becoming increasingly more difficult for our smaller collaboration to maintain the staffing needs to adequately provide this service due to a national shortage of qualified medical examiners. Last year, the Wall Street Journal reported that a 58-year-old man collapsed and died at a convenience store in eastern Montana. His body had to be driven 300 miles to South Dakota for an autopsy because there was no one in Montana to examine the body. This situation highlights the nation's scant supply of forensic pathologists and makes larger regional collaborations in providing this service a must. Second, the facility at Regina was no longer able to meet OSHA requirements with respect to autopsies and infectious disease death investigations. It lacked the needed security to assure integrity for the storage of property and exhibits. It had insufficient space to perform autopsies and physical space storage, which required refrigeration. And it had no capacity for expanding future needs based on the growth in death investigations and autopsies. In short, the facility was simply no longer adequate. And while we were aware that within 4 to 7 years, the Hennepin County facility would also be inadequate, it would have been a great waste of tax dollars to build a new facility in 2013 and 2014 to serve Scott and Dakota counties, and then to have Hennepin County need to build a new facility in just a few more years. Again, the right thing to do for our citizens is to provide a larger regional collaboration when there is a need for these types of facilities. And finally, the Hennepin County Medical Examiner's Office was and is one of the best in the nation. So if you're going to create a larger regional facility, it only makes sense to partner with the experts, and Dr. Baker and his staff are exceptional. As we begin to prepare for the construction of a new facility, we would ask the legislature to join Hennepin, Dakota, and Scott counties in funding this new facility to support a projected population growth and the expanding needs within our regional service area and in other counties throughout the state over the next 25 years. As the supply of forensic pathologists gets even tighter and older facilities in other areas begin to fail, the need for this service becomes even greater. This proposal is exactly the type of local request that the legislature should embrace. The planned project will serve a significant public need and for a large segment of the state's population in multiple jurisdictions. The facility is phased in its implementation with future expansion capability and will be built at a location that best supports access needs for the founding counties and a growing geographic service area. The three founding counties are requesting capital dollars for a facility whose operation will then be funded through the counties and not the state. On behalf of Scott County, I would strongly encourage you to support this capital project. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. We do appreciate you being here. Any questions for the testifiers? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner and Dr. Baker, for being here. As part of the bonding tour, when the bonding committee came to Minneapolis, they actually did tour the facility, and while it may not be for the faint of heart, it was stunning how much they have shoehorned things into spaces that are totally inadequate and in some ways disrespectful of the people whose care or families have entrusted the solving of mysteries to them. And you know, there's just no room for just even the basics of interaction and staff activity within that space. And so it's a critical need. The other thing is that I think people should realize that they also have a role in teaching and training others, and that that is a contribution to everyone in this business in our state, not just those who are served by the counties that are based out of this facility.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. I just had a question about the amendment that is site specific. What is the current use of that site?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the current site for which we now have a letter of intent with the seller is a vacant piece of land. So we do not have to raise any building that's already there. The land is ideally sized in terms of the acreage that we need. It is literally right off of 494 between Highway 100 and Highway 169. We would have been hard-pressed to come up with a more ideal location for serving all of our customers and making ourselves much more attractive to coroner counties around us in terms of ease of getting to us.
And Dr. Baker, as is that currently held by a unit of government, or will it have to be transferred for the project to be bondable?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's currently owned by a private corporation who has agreed to sell it to Hennepin County. And Hennepin County, by the way, is absorbing the full cost of purchasing the land. That's okay. Not included in the bonding bill.
So the land itself will be owned by Hennepin County?
Correct.
Okay. All right. And also I noticed on the map that there's several locations for examiners, and I think I remember you telling me that one of these is likely going to be closing in the near future. You talked just a little bit about where these services are located in the travel times and that kind of thing.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, I can address that question. The office, quote-unquote, that will be closing in the near future is the star you see on your map in the Hibbing region. For many, many years, that area has been served by a single forensic pathologist. Several years ago, he started sending some of his cases to my office for no other reason than he needed relief because he was working 7 days a week, 365 days a year. He would very much like to retire. I believe most of the cases he is currently handling are going through a contractual arrangement to the Anoka County office. And there will come a time in the very near future when we do not have a forensic pathologist physically located in the Arrowhead. And again, when you're talking about a national supply of 500 and a deficit of at least twice that many, it's going to be much more cost effective to transport those cases to an Anoka or a Hennepin or a Ramsey rather than believe you're going to be able to recruit a solo practitioner into an operation like that. In terms of the rest of the map that you're looking at, and you may have a map that's got a variety of different colors on it, many of those counties go to Ramsey. Many of those counties go to Anoka. Obviously, Hennepin, Dakota, and Scott come to me. There are a few counties where the coroners have arrangements to send the body to the single forensic pathologist in Sioux Falls. And as I think I mentioned in my testimony, there's a handful of counties that currently transport their bodies to Grand Forks, which is a nationally accredited office. It just happens to be in North Dakota, but geographically it's much more convenient for them.
So that on the map that you provided to us in our packets, there's two stars that are basically on the borderline for Minnesota, one in the northwest and one in the southwest. Would those two stars be Sioux Falls and Grand Forks?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
I don't like to lose any business to North or South Dakota. Even this business. So I think it's important to realize then that it would just basically be that if we lost the Arrowhead site in Minnesota, we just have the Metro and Rochester, and that's basically it.
Correct. And if, Mr. Chair, if I could add one more thing, my office also takes referral cases from Wisconsin from time to time. Again, we're geographically much closer to many far western Wisconsin counties than their nearest qualified medical examiner office would be. And to provide the best service, we sometimes ignore the fact that there are state lines in between.
I like that. Good. All right. Other questions? All right, seeing none, I also just want to follow up to Representative Loeffler. Thank you for inviting us in, and all, I know other members are welcome to tour as well and see that you are really dealing with cramped conditions there, and are overloaded but do a great job and a high degree of professionalism with yourself and your staff, and I'm sure it'll be nice to see that moved a little bit south. So thank you for coming to the committee. Representative Albright, anything else?
Thank you, Chair and members, for your consideration.
Thank you. With that, Representative, House File 2496 is laid over. Thank you for the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Great.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. Next up, we have House File 2436, Representative Joaquim. Representative Joaquim, welcome to the committee. I will move House File 2346 be laid over. We have the bill before us. I understand that there is an A16-088 amendment that's an author's amendment. I'm going to move the A16-088 amendment. Representative Joaquim, is there any discussion to this amendment?
Thank you, Chair. First, I want to say thank you for hearing this bill, and thank you to the members of the committee. As a dutiful freshman, I understand tradition, and I have not been before this committee before, so I did a little baking last night. So I hope you enjoy the cookies. They're molasses cookies. They're family recipes. So the amendment actually does change the bill. It originally... our bill was asking for $3.5 million, which was half the total cost of the project. We've lowered it to $600,000, which is the planning, pre-design, and design of the project total cost, so that they can do a little bit more work on making sure they couldn't spend all the money all at once. So they want to do this in phases. While Perspectives, Inc. is in my district in St. Louis Park, it really is a regional program that helps women, homeless women and their children. It's been providing services for 40 years and has a wonderful track record. I know you have a very full agenda, so I'm going to turn over the rest of the presentation to Jeannie Taylor-Smith, the President and CEO of Perspectives, Inc., who will quickly explain their program and what the project would mean for them, but I know the amendment's on the table right now, too. So.
All right. Thank you, Representative Joaquim. We have the 088 amendment before us. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Representative, the amendment is adopted. Ms. Smith, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, and I welcome the time to be here and to explain to you a little bit of our project. I am Jeannie Seeley-Smith, the President and CEO of Perspectives for 34 years. I have operated right now the largest supportive housing program in the state of Minnesota for 25 years. The program serves women who are coming directly out of shelter and their children. So you might have a picture of one of the families here. This woman arrived 3 years ago. She had her baby in our program. She was pregnant when she came, and she came with very little history of sobriety. She was has mental health issues, and the children arrived traumatized. If you haven't been in a shelter within Hennepin County or within St. Paul, you should visit and see the looks of the faces of the children. So Perspectives exist to work with these families. We have a long track record with them. They come into our housing program. Everything is furnished. Everything is given within the refrigerators. There's food. They have linens. Everything is ready for this woman to jumpstart her life. And the woman that you're looking, if you do see her, she is now 3 years sober. She has a job, and her children are stabilized, and they have had the youngest child has had several hours of mental health treatment. The children experience homelessness in our nation are the most invisible and neglected individuals in our nation. Despite the fact that they have ever-growing numbers that we have ever-growing numbers of homeless children, they have really no voice, and they have no constitutional rights in a way of where they have been. without a refrigerator, without possessions. The children enter our program, and they are just shell-shocked. So our need for this new building is to expand the services that we are providing for the children. We will be adding a 4,000-square-foot area for therapeutic programming for children who are coming out of homelessness. We will be providing more mental health for the women. We have a Rule 31, so we're able to provide chemical dependency programming. That makes us probably the uniquest model within the nation. No other supportive housing program has a family center that comes with it. They have housing, they have case management, but they don't have a home for where the families can go and rebuild their lives. And that's the uniqueness of our program. We have searched the nation. We haven't found a program like ours. We do believe that we are a very unique model, and that with that we're able to break the cycle of homelessness. Now, if we don't, if that woman that you're looking at, if she doesn't come to us and she comes out of shelter, probably her highest risk would that be she would be incarcerated very shortly because of untreated drug use. That would cost our state at least $35,000 for her. Her children in foster care would be another. If she had two children, that's $8,000 apiece. So we're looking at that family costing $50,000 to our it compared to the services in breaking the cycle and being with us, that we can serve a whole family for 1 year for $28,000. So that is when they could leave us, however, we believe that we have stopped the revolving door. Recidivism in a prison is 20%, so we spend $50,000 on that family, and we could spend it again after her sentence and she is released and comes back. So the investment in what I'm asking and our board of directors and staff are asking for prospectus, we think has a very good track record and a very good return to investment. So I thank you for considering it. I think that we are either going to invest early now in families or we're going to pay for them later. So I thank you for your consideration. I know you make hard decisions. I hope I made this one easy for you.
Thank you, Ms. Smith. We appreciate your testimony. Is there any questions for the testifiers? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question for you. I see that in the bill, it's actually probably for both the Representative Joachim and your testifier, says in the bill that the funds will be distributed once non-state sources are met or expanded. So what funds have you already collected at this point for the project?
We haven't collected any from the public funding. We have raised over $1.5 million ourselves. We bought the land, the parking lot across the street. That's a St. Louis Park area, of course, and that so we have that land so that we had to have that land before we could expand our building because of the parking ordinances. So we have purchased the land and we'll build that for $500,000. We have our board of directors and our staff have raised with in-house have raised over $800,000.
Mr. Representative McDonald.
Thank you. So $1 million at this point was raised. Is that all through donations?
Yes. Mm-hmm. This is our first time to the state. Yeah.
And Mr. Chairman. So Mary Jo Copeland from Sharing Caring Hands, I believe they offer, of course, very similar programs and housing for families and women with children. Is there anything that they have done? Have you maybe consulted? I suppose that Prospectus has, maybe worked with her and see how she's able to do that with all donations and no state money. Is that kind of a collaboration that perhaps that you guys had in the past? And I just ask for curiosity.
Right.
I'm a big fan of Mary Jo Copeland. Donald, yep. The hamburgers.
That is a shelter. Mary Jo has a shelter, and that's 30 days. Our program, a woman comes and we work with them for 3 years. So a shelter is a very expensive way to deal with this population. It's a necessity. And it's a sadness of our country that we have to have these emergency shelters and that they have to go there before they get to us. So we are much different in the sense that we have 53 moms that are with us at any given time and over 100 children within our housing campus. So when they arrive, they have their own apartment and they have case management and mental health workers and they have CD workers. It's a wraparound service. So it's very, very unlike what she's doing, even though what she is doing is obviously very necessary. We would be taking her families to our supportive housing. We're the next on the continuum housing, we have emergency shelter, and then supportive housing, and then affordable. So we're right here.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you. Well, definitely, in my humble opinion, are doing God's work, especially when it comes to mothers and children. What are your stories of victory? I won't call them success, but victory, when you see the parents, the moms, and their children come in, and you help them with so many issues, and as they graduate or as they move on, are you tracking their victories of the children and having them growing up and breaking sometimes the cycles of homelessness and many other things that can happen to them?
Mr. Chair, we have huge stories of victories. We have women who have gone from us, our place, and have bought homes. We don't have a long history of 25 years to be able to know all of our alumni. We've served over 3,000 women and close to 5,000 children. So we don't have all of that. It's like Rome is burning. We don't have the numbers to be able to go out and send out coaches and find out where everybody is. So we're just practice. We have something right now that we have to work on day to day with this family where they are. So we do believe that we break cycles, and we have families coming back to us all the time with great stories. Women who leave, they leave with jobs. Their income is up. Their children are stable. It's because of the model that we have created, which is this wraparound comprehensive trauma-informed care model. So the first thing we do with the woman is stabilize her and her family, and we work with that. And we get the children enrolled in school. We start working with the we have such a large support system within St. Louis Park. We're able to, right away, from the time that woman comes to us, we're able to start working with her. There's not a lot of, she has to stay sober, and she has to be involved in our program. And I think that keeps them excited, and we are celebrating their accomplishments. And the women, if we had them here, they love to tell about their stories. They love to tell about their victories. And I think it's what kept me here for 34 years. If it wasn't working, I don't think I would have stayed. And I think all the board members that we have and the people that we have been able to recruit around us are testimony to the great outcomes. 78% of the women will leave our program and will re-enter a social and economic mainstream.
Mr. Chair, then just lastly, keep up the good work. Representative Joaquin, thank you for bringing this forward. In partnership with our religious friends out in the community and our nonprofit groups and government, we can come together to solve problems. So thank you for your good work on this.
Thank
and
you.
I presume that your work with the other organizations, the churches in St. Louis Park well?
We have a huge resource of the faith community around us and community services. We have, of course, the St. Louis Park School District. We interface with them on a daily basis. So lots of supports and partnerships. Thank you for your questions.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And following up on that discussion, I just wanted to underscore the network that has to exist and what we've learned about homelessness and trauma-induced models when we have to treating families who are going through crisis. And it's much more than just providing them a good warm meal or a roof over their head. It really is about putting lives back together, providing adequate health care, mental health care, chemical dependency care, and also treating and observing and providing access to the children who may be living through trauma. This is really about providing these services, and these wraparound services are so important because the science tells us that these kids are on a really dangerous path if we don't use science-based models to support these families. And so essentially what we get to do is leverage what we do at the state level, because hopefully where we're going is seeing fewer and fewer children who are experiencing the brain injury that comes along with long-term poverty, the brain injury that comes along with living through childhood trauma. So the fact that this is science-based health-based is, I think, incredibly important to recognize. And I think that that's the reason that we are seeing this at the state level.
Thank you, Representative Halverson. No other questions. Is there anyone else in the audience who'd like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, Representative Joaquin, any final thoughts?
I just want to thank you for the committee's time and the chair's time, and I hope you'll consider this when you send your bonding recommendations forward.
Thank you, Representative. And with that, House File 2346, as amended, is laid over. All right. Is Representative Dabney here? He is here. Next up, we have House File 2247. Representative Dabney, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I don't get here very often.
No, welcome. Good to see you. Representative Dabney, I will move House File 2247 be laid over. I understand there are no amendments to this bill.
Mr. Chair, just to correct the record, 2274.
Oh, sorry. This is not a bill on dyslexia. So House File 2274. I will move 2274. The bill is before us. Representative Dabney, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'm pleased today to be here with the Family Partnership. The Family Partnership is an institution in this state, a 138-year-old institution in this state that provides a variety of vital services, mental health counseling, preschool services, importantly services supporting women getting out of sex trafficking situations, multilingual and multicultural services to the communities, not only in my district in Hennepin County, but also professional development opportunities that reach across the state to better train professionals in serving those communities and providing those services. We're here today with a request for state support for a new facility to allow them to center all of their offices in one location to achieve some efficiencies and some cost savings, as well as expand their reach through technology and better facilities both for their clients and for the professional development opportunities that they provide. With me today, I've got two individuals and what has to be a huge percentage of the board of the Family Partnership. If the board could wave. You see, there's a large presence here today, but I have Ms. Greenman, who is the executive director?
President.
Poobah. And then we have a mom who is also present, Angel Richmond, who's she and her children have been involved in the services, and she will speak as well. But at this time, Mr. Chair, if Ms. Greenman could have the microphone, that would be great.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Greenman. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Molly Greenman, President and CEO of the Family Partnership. And thank you, Representative Dabney, for your great support on this bill. And I'd also like to thank Representative Hamilton and Allen, who also authored this bill. And I really want to take the opportunity today to thank everybody on this committee for your support on Safe Harbor. You know, the Family Partnership with Jeff Bauer has been a leader in this effort, and I think it's a great example of how we can, as a state, reach across party lines and really come together for some very vulnerable children. So thank you all for your work on that. As Representative Dabney said, the Family Partnership was started in 1878. We actually were started as part of the Humane Movement because this was a period of time in our country when animals were afforded more protection than children. And we've been caring for and advocating for children and families ever since. Today, we are focused on our vision of closing opportunity and achievement gaps for our community's most vulnerable kids and families. And last year, we served over 35,000 people. If we were a city, we would be the 28th largest city in Minneapolis. 85% of our participants are living in or right next door to poverty, and the vast majority are, in fact, children under 17. We have six metro locations. Three in South Central Minneapolis, one which is actually on the corner of Golden Valley and North Minneapolis, where we are an anchor partner of the Northside Achievement Zone, and an office in Brooklyn Park and Richfield. But as important, we are in hundreds of schools, community sites, churches, and homes, because we want to be where vulnerable kids and families are when they need our help the most. And we don't just have reach, we have results in our counseling and education and advocacy programs. In counseling, 80% of children and adults who are using our mental health services overcome depression, anxiety, violence, and other issues, which allows them to stay in school, succeed in their jobs, and keep their families together. 85% of our children in our therapeutic preschools, all of whom are coming from families living in poverty, are graduating from our high-quality, four-star parent-aware therapeutic preschools ready for kindergarten. 85%, which I think is remarkable. We're very proud of that. 70% of the women and children in our Pride program develop safety plans and positive support networks, which is absolutely critical to getting out, getting away from sex trafficking, and staying out. So we've been very successful, and that has created incredible growth. Also, compelling growth is the increasing needs in our community. We had 60% growth in the last 5 years, and a few years ago, we found ourselves out of space. So our board and community leaders came up with a plan for a 45,000-square-foot facility, which will bring together three of our South Central locations in one to allow, as Representative Dabney said, room for growth, but also operational efficiency and more effectiveness in our programs. The site we found is in the Phillips Powderhorn neighborhood of South Minneapolis, which is an incredibly diverse and dynamic neighborhood. It is also quite distressed. 1 out of 5 Minneapolitans live in this area. 57% of them are living in or right next door to poverty. 43% have only a high school diploma or less, and 21% are without health insurance. And as for sex trafficking, well, it's really ground zero. I got to tell you, we had our board take a tour of the neighborhood after we found our site. It was about 12 o'clock in the afternoon. And as I'm telling them about the neighborhood and issues and that kind of thing, right on the corner, there's two young women standing there. A car drives up, and when the car leaves, there's only one young woman left. So it's 24/7 in that neighborhood, and we think that's where we need to be. The facility, half of which will, over half actually, will be dedicated to our multicultural therapeutic preschool programming. It'll have 23 therapy rooms for mental health, but also occupational, speech, and physical therapy for our littlest learners, most of whom have mild to moderate delays due to trauma. It will have expanded, safe, and confidential space for women and children who are escaping sex trafficking so that they can get services and support to help them rebuild their lives. And we'll have more community space to bring community leaders and professionals together for training and the technology so that we can extend that training and expertise and evidence-based programming to professionals all over the state. Last but I don't think least, the building will really serve as a physical commitment to the community to transform a very distressed community and be there for generations of vulnerable kids and families to come. The project cost is $23.5 million. Over half of that will come from private philanthropy. We expect $4 million in new market tax credits and $1 million from the sale of our current property and perhaps some environmental grants. So today we're hoping for $5 million in support from the state of Minnesota in this really urgently needed and exciting project for kids and families across the state. I'd like to introduce Angel Richmond. Angel is here today. She's participated in a number of our programs. I will also tell you it is her birthday today, so I'm really thankful for you for coming.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Richmond. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Angel Richmond. I've been participating in the Family Partnership Program for about 9 years now. I have 4 kids, which all of them have been through the Family Partnership. And I choose the Family Partnership because they're the most supportive, and I count on them for the development of my children from my oldest child on. Very supportive. I've been through therapy with them, and that's been awesome for me. I also do parenting through the Family Partnership, which has helped me a great deal with a lot of situations in my life and in my family life. The therapy has helped me with situations with abuse, and Family Partnership is a very important part of my family's life and mine, and I would hope you guys support them too. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony today, Ms. Richmond, and happy birthday.
Thank you.
Do we have questions for the testifiers?
Mr. Chairman, I have a question.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. Richmond, how are your children doing, if you don't mind me asking? If I ask too personal of questions.
Actually, please. My children are doing great. My youngest is 10 months, and she works with the staff at the Family Partnership now. She's not in the preschool yet because she's not 16 months yet, but she still works with the staff, working on her, just to monitor her development skills. But my two-year-old is in the preschool right now. Before he started the preschool, there was big concerns about his development. But since he started the preschool, he took off like a rocket. And I appreciate that very much. So there, the concerns, like, kind of ended once he started, because I was going to get him tested and this and that. I thought there was something wrong with him, developmentally and stuff. But once he got started with Family Partnership, the what they teach him there, and the activities and stuff, it's to the levels where the kids just catch on to it. It's routine, you know, and they catch on and they love it, and they just learn from it, I guess, and they take off, like, you know, and it's just awesome. I love it.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Thank you, and happy birthday.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Thank you. Representative
Allen. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to acknowledge what you do and the importance, and which side of Lake Street will you be on? On the south or north side?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Allen, we will be on, that is the south side, Bloomington and Lake.
Okay. Mr. Chair. And I just want to stress the importance of having these community centers. I mean, we have some of the oldest Representative Clark's area. We have Waite House. We have the Women's Resource Center, Indigenous Peoples Task Force, ISD. And then on the other side, we have there's very few community centers. We have Sabathany. Has been there for decades. And these places where families go, it's the first place they go for services. And to have a place that utilizes so many different clinicians, advocates, and that it's really focusing on bringing community partners together. And this is an organization that works really well with other community stakeholders, and so in a long history, as you can see, it's over 100 years old. And so the importance of I work a lot with families that are, as an attorney, that are where the children have already been removed from the home, or there's this really short window for the mother to reunify with their children. And the struggle is always to get services for that family to keep them together. And so having a place to go where you take your child with you, where they get the services they need there, and then, you know, once they get into the foster care system, I mean, the expense of providing those services and paying for the care is just, it's, I don't know how many times greater it is than what you're providing where you're at the front line. And so the effectiveness, I know, I've seen it in many young families, to keep the family together is really focusing on that on the trauma that and that homelessness and economic insecurity causes, and then parenting and really providing that. And oftentimes that working on those things first and then the other things follow, the long-term sobriety, the and oftentimes families, it that generational, oftentimes you can see it in how much improvement is made in one person's life, and then it sort of resonates to a sister or an auntie, or and then all of a sudden you have the entire family that is as involved in, and so families no longer feel isolated, and so that, I'm sort of rambling here, but it's just amazing what happens to families when they get the services they need. So thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who'd like to testify on this? Seeing none, Representative Dabney, any final thoughts?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I certainly appreciate your time and attention today. Hearing Ms. Richmond talk about her boy and taken off like a rocket just caused me to reflect that this committee does a significant amount of work in setting policy for the well-being of all Minnesotans, but it's not we policymakers who really make the difference. It's the practitioners who are working hand-in-hand, hands-on with the children of the state. For that to happen, they need facilities that support and facilitate their professional practice and then also allow them to extend that practice and training of what works across the state. And that's what this proposal is asking for, is a modern facility with modern technology to allow modern practitioners to work with today's kids and support them and their families so that all Minnesotans get a strong start. I appreciate your time today and consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Dabney, and thanks to the testifiers and also the board members who took time out today to be here today. We do appreciate it. With that, Representative 2274 is laid over. Next up, we have Representative Wiginius and House File 2443.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Welcome to the committee, Representative Wiginius. I will move House File 2443 be laid over. We have the bill before us. I don't have any amendments that I am aware of in the packet. Representative Wiginius, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I'm a member of LCCMR. That's the Legislative Citizens Commission on Minnesota Resources. And for those of you who are not familiar with that, it's a group of legislators and citizens who make recommendations on how to spend the interest on the trust fund that gets its money from the lottery. And one of the proposals that came before LCCMR this last cycle was from the Lincoln Pipestone Waterworks. And they wanted money to buy some land to protect their drinking water wells. And by consensus, LCCMR recommended giving them $1.5 million. That bill, the LCCMR bill, is now working its way through the process and in committees. But here's the problem, and this is the problem I bring to you. Lincoln Pipestone isn't the only community with a large need to protect its drinking water. The Minnesota Department of Health has worked with drinking water operators across the state, and this is municipal well operators, and identified 1.2 million acres of land that needs to be protected in some way, and more specifically, 350,000 acres of land where the geology makes the drinking water vulnerable or very vulnerable to contamination. Of that 350,000 acres right now, the Department of Health has identified only 2,000 acres that have been protected. The bill I am bringing before you provides financial help to drinking water operators and their communities to protect their source water. This is a statewide issue. I'm going to tell you a little bit more about Lincoln Pipestone because it's a good example, and then about my bill, because basically what the bill does is just expand on what LCCMR did for Lincoln Pipestone and make money available to other communities. The CEO of Lincoln Pipestone testified before LCCMR, and unfortunately, he has moved to another state. But the taped testimony is available, and I have given it to your committee, and I understand it will be in the minutes. So if folks want to listen to his specific testimony, there is a link where you can do that. And so that will come, I think, in your minutes, I'm hoping. Okay. Lincoln Pipestone specifically serves 10 counties, 38 cities. 60% of its water, this is from the CEO, 60% of its water comes from public wells situated mainly in row crop agriculture. Now, when I gave you the figure of 350,000 acres of land and areas that's vulnerable or very vulnerable, about 115,000 of that is covered by row crop. So two-thirds of it, more than two-thirds of it, is not. In Lincoln Pipestone, where they have a problem, the soil is sandy, the water table is high, it's very susceptible to drought, and it is interconnected with, this is a huge interconnected system. There is one community that it's interconnected with, it's called Adrian. The Star Tribune did a story on Adrian, the governor visited there, and I have that story to share with you as a handout. Lincoln Pipestone says that they need 5,700 well acres in their wellhead protection plan. That's what they worked on with the Department of Health. They say that conservation steps will help, but won't protect the water because of the vulnerability. That land that was once in CRP is coming out of CRP. That was protected, but it's no longer there for protection. And specifically, the treating water after contamination is far more expensive than treating water prevention. So Lincoln Pipestone said that the only solution was to buy land, and LCCMR essentially gave, or is proposing to give them money, $1.5 million to buy around 200 acres. They'll put it in native grasses and flowers, and that protects the drinking water, but it also makes it far less vulnerable to drought. In the bill, in the LCCMR, it says that you can not just put your land if you in just grasses, but you could put a windmill on it. As long as the water is protected and any income that you got from something like a windmill would go to buy more land to protect the water. So let me just go over a couple sentences in the bill because it's different than the, most of the bills you get. It's what is $20 million for the Commissioner of Health for competitive grants to public drinking water suppliers. to buy land and fee to protect drinking water systems. There should be multiple benefits, which are listed, and I told you, like, you can put a windmill on. So that is in there, and then another $10 million to the Commission of Natural Resources also to acquire land, but this would be more like hunting land. So I'm going to give you a couple of handouts just so you get a sense of the problem, and so maybe the page could just hand out this from... And I give you this just because of its title. It says, Town's Contaminated Water Highlights a Larger Problem for Minnesota, and that's what we're trying to address here. But let me give you some other examples of communities that have run into problems because of nitrates in their drinking water. And one would be Park Rapids, where they're now spending $3,000 per household to clean up their water. This is happening in other places in the state. The other example I'm going to give you is Hastings. And I'm giving you that specifically because the PCA just recently came out and said that Hastings will need to spend about $9 million on their drinking water system to get the nitrates out of their drinking water system. But there's a double problem here. So this is a map of what the protection area looks like for Hastings, and I'm going to have maps for you for some of your communities too, but this is a map of Hastings. But here's the other confounding problem in a bit. We didn't print lots of stuff because they're color, but you can look at Dakota County where the Department of Agriculture is tested, and the red is wells where there's more than 10 parts of nitrogen, which is over our standard. Where there is nitrogen, there will be pesticides, and where there's lots of nitrogen, there will be lots of pesticides. These are private wells, but look at where these private wells are located. They are in the area that should be in the source water protection area for the city of Hastings, which is right here. So, more maps for you. And then I'm going to hand out a packet of maps that are just miscellaneous maps, some showing high vulnerability, some showing low vulnerability, just so you get a sense of what the Department of Health has been working on with communities in order to try to protect our drinking water sources. But here we are now, we've made plans, but we have not implemented them. And that's what I'm coming to you for, is implementation. And with that, I would be glad to take questions.
Thank you, Representative Lugenius. Do we have any questions? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lugenius, you know this area far more than we do. But if I'm understanding correctly, this is really kind of a public health effort that will... It is a prevention effort so that it will actually save money from the people buying water or communities having to deal with it, and that the communities would apply for this grant program if it's for properties within their area, or if it's DNR, undeveloped land or whatever, they would apply. But it's at the communities. Do you have a sense of, given that you know that there's a variety of communities out there that are seeking this, is the figure that you have here, $20 million, does that mean like one half of the applications that you're aware of, or do you have any sense of the demand at this point?
I don't have a sense of the demand except for Lincoln Pipestone, who actually came forth and said, this is it, please help us. And they are saying, we have 5,700 acres that need protecting. And if you look at the big number, 350,000 acres of vulnerable across the state, that's a huge number. I don't expect we would certainly buy it all, but in some places, particularly in those areas where it's sandy, water table is high, susceptible to drought, that the only way, and that's what Lincoln Pipestone testified, the only way they could protect their drinking water was to buy the land. But do I have a sense of the big picture? No. Except that it's big.
Thank you. I mean, it seems like water's just sort of a basic that we count on, and, you know, we certainly don't want to become like Flint, where you have to dump bottled water into your bathtub or for your kids or whatever. But it just seems like if we can prevent further deterioration, that would be a good investment, both financially for the state but also for the communities.
All right. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, Representative Guinness, any final thoughts?
Just one final thought, members. We have not talked much about drinking water in the state of Minnesota, and I think there are lots of folks that don't want to talk about it, but Michigan has told us we have to talk about it. And this is the time that we have to understand what's going on with our drinking water, which for legislators, I'm guessing a lot of folks have not discussed this issue, and I just feel fortunate because I've been on LCCMR. We talk about this stuff all the time. So with that, if people have questions for me, I'm glad to share them with you. So maps coming around so folks can see other communities and what's going on in other communities.
Great. Thank you, Representative Wagenius. And with that, 2443 is laid over. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you.